Accession number 30284, reel 9.
Ryan Nesbitt, reel 9.
Well, the point about this instructor course, it was only number 2 instructor's course at Greenwich. There'd been one before us. And I suppose that one before us was when I was waiting on the squadron doing administrative work and was then sent on this number 2 instructor's course. To some extent, there was instruction in the air. We had Anson's there. And we, I think, learnt how to make people fill up their logs correctly in the air, and we taught them how to the Anson had an astrodome, how to operate their sextant and so on, but most of it was classroom stuff.
And was it specifically a navigator's instruction course, or was it just an instructor's course?
Well, I've got a photograph of the instructors there and of the course members, myself sitting in the front, incidentally. And some of them were pilots, but I think some of the pilots on the photographs were chaps who flew us about in Anson's. There were one or two pilots, I think, taking the course, but almost all of them were air observers. Very few of them were air observers with any operational experience. Yes, so anyway, they were mostly, the air observers, were mostly chaps who had not had any operational experience. I think only one or two of us had. They were what was called creamed off their courses. The chaps who were top of their courses and usually given commissions and made to be instructors. The handicap with the RF at that time was insufficient instructors. Obviously, it was being expanded at a tremendous rate. How did you do it? You could only take the best pilots off their own courses, the best navigators or air observers off their courses, and turn them into instructors. And this took place principally at Greenwich. It was quite a large course. And, of course, we were needed. And once you became an instructor, it was difficult to become anything else because you were churning up more and more people. And that's what they wanted me to do. And it was, I think, because I came top of the ground subjects all the way along the line, and incidentally became top of the course on credit as well when I was there, that I was made to be an instructor. I didn't want to be one. I thought I should do something active in group headquarters, but in later life, it has proved very beneficial to me, that course.
What would you say the benefits that you gain from it are, specifically?
Well, I may not be doing it now, but I would say that to deliver a subject matter coherently and logically, for example, I have had to give lectures at the National Archives. I have had to give... I taught at University Crammers after, you know, my postgraduate year at university, which I have been able to give talks, maybe almost 100 on BBC radio and so on. My voice is getting a bit hoarse now, so it's not so good as it used to be, but the way I do it, I suppose, is fairly clear. I'm always the chap who has to get up and make speeches at, on occasions as chairman of the Beaufort Aircrew Association. I'm always the mug who has to get up at weddings and so on, like, to give talks. And this wasn't something which came naturally to me. It was taught at RF Greenwich. But the teachers were mostly civilians. They had people who'd studied this, I think at Cambridge and Oxford, that sort of thing, and found out the best way to deliver a subject in the simplest possible way. I could also tell that from my own experience in grammar school, how inept some of the teachers were in their method of transmitting information. And this is also true of university. They just get up there and waffle, these chaps, but not deliver the subject matter in any coherent form.
How long was the course?
About 2 months, thereabouts.
And it sounds like you got some enjoyment out of actually doing it once you got involved.
Well, I did. I realised that I was learning something which was beneficial. And it also got rid of my shyness, I suppose, and most people, they're told to get up and talk to a crowd of people, won't like it very much. You know, they want to shy away from it. But in my case, it no longer worried me.
At the end of the course, were you aware where you were going to be posted to, or was that, again, something that you weren't sure what would happen?
Not immediately. I was sent home and then told I was posted to Southern Rhodesia. I hastily checked my atlas to find out where Southern Rhodesia was. and thought, well, this could be quite a pleasant change. It was also quite interesting because my father's three elder brothers had fought in the Boer War, and two of those brothers had remained in South Africa, so I had probably more relatives in South Africa than I did have in England. The other brother had been killed in the First World War, but the others had prospered and got families out there in South Africa. So there was also the attraction of travelling, because to see foreign lands was interesting to me. So I wasn't averse to going to South Africa or to Rhodesia.
So how did you go about doing that? You received the posting, and what's the next stage?
Well, I was told to report to Liverpool Docks. I wasn't told what was going to happen. I had to go to Liverpool Docks. I suppose I must have known I was going to Rhodesia beforehand. Southern Rhodesia. In those days it was Northern Rhodesia and Southern Rhodesia. Now, of course, it's Zimbabwe and Zambia. But anyway, when I got there, I found that I was told to go aboard the SS Rangitiki, a New Zealand liner, which had been transferred to a troop ship. And I was there in advance. Why was I there in advance? I didn't. As usual, I'd been picked up for an administrative job. I was in charge of EDEC. It was when all the troops came aboard and all the other instructors or people going out there, I was the mug who was there to begin with and told to look after EDEC. And the officers, as we were fairly comfortably billeted. But all these poor troops down below in their hammocks, you know, almost touching each other, absolutely crammed to capacity. I mean, they weren't like that, because during the day, but at night, they were hundreds of them in this great liner, the SS Rangitiki. And we took off, I don't have the exact date, from Liverpool in a convoy. I didn't know how long it would take, but I took my sextant with me and had a very rough atlas and was able to plot our position at night. And the convoy went way, way out into the Atlantic, into the Southern Atlantic, almost to South America, and curved all the way around until we came into Durban. Nothing happened, so far as I'm aware, to the convoy. You know, this was the height of the U-boat menace, of course, and what they were doing was avoiding the U-boats which were operating from the place which we had recently attacked on the west coast of France. I mean, this is where they were coming from, and we were... The whole journey took 6 weeks, way, way around in a big circle up to Durban. And when we got into Durban, because I made friends on the way, there were other instructors going out to the same area as myself, although not to the same station as it happens. I was posted to 20 service flying school at Cranbourne near Salisbury, which is the capital now, Harare. But when we landed at the docks, an amazing sight. On the end of the pier, there was a very large lady dressed in white. You probably know about her, but she was singing Land of Hope and Glory through a megaphone at us. We stood and looked at the rail of the ship with utter amazement at this sight. This statuesque creature singing Land of Hope and Glory. You know, we all clapped and cheered, but apparently this lady in white, you may know, greeted every warship or vessel coming into Durban Harbour. How she had the intelligence information, I don't know. She must have been in colleague with the naval staff there, knowing what has happened. But she was, I think she met every warship, every troopship which came into Durban throughout the war. Astonishing, astonishing business. Anyway, we were in, I think, in Durban for a couple of days or something like that before. I remember going in a rickshaw, which was what was unusual, and then getting up to Cranbourne, which is a few miles away from Salisbury, the main capital.
How did you get up there from Durban?
By train. It went all the way up to Salisbury. It's a long journey. It's a several days' journey getting up there. Quite very comfortable in first-class compartment and so on. It was okay. And obviously, South Africa and to some extent Rhodesia were the land of plenty. It was very, very comfortable. And the climate, of course, in Rhodesia, southern Rhodesia, was absolutely superb. It's high, you know. It's about 3,000 or 4,000 feet, and the subtropical conditions are ameliorated because of the height, and temperature was absolutely ideal.
So what was the station like?
Well, it was a service flying training school. By this time I was a flying officer. I had been recommended for a DFC, but it didn't arrive, but I did get a mention in dispatches. But I was getting on towards my flight lieutenant stage, I suppose, and I reported to the station, Cranbourne, which is the largest station, I think, in the whole of South Africa. It was full of aircraft, mostly Harvards, and we were teaching pilots the element of navigation. I went there, there were two pilots there who were giving these instructions. But the course results have been very poor there. I was given a course, and using these methods learnt at Greenwich, they got the best marks obtained in the whole. There were all five or six stations in Salisbury, they got the best marks at the end. So, anyway, I was then appointed a senior navigation officer. The two pilots were posted away, and the course was rapidly built up to a person of seven. There were pilots who did instruction in the air, navigators or air observers who did the instruction on the ground, and I was given a secretary, who was a Mrs. Pearson. She was what was called a WASI. What was it? No, I don't know what it stood for. Women's Army Air Force Rhodesian Service or something like that. A middle-aged lady who did all my secretarial work. Eventually, more and more arrived, and the courses became more and more numerous. We were turning up lots and lots of people.
To what depth were you teaching them navigation at that?
Not very deep, but my work became almost entirely administrative. I had to report on the progress of these chaps to make... had other instructors who were given the courses. I think I only attended one, only gave myself one or two. It was a heck of a lot of administrative work. And not only that, as soon as I arrived there, they started to pile administrative jobs onto me. First one was parachute officer.
What did that entail?
Organising the parachute section. There were mostly seats there. There were civilians working there. I had to try to improve their work practices and so on, learn how they packed and so on, and ensure that they were properly done and get the packs put in the various crew rooms around the airfield and in parachute boxes and so on. And then I was given the job of station photographic officer. And there were camera guns that were used in the aircraft and a certain amount of survey work which went on. So I went in there and tried to organise things, and I learnt how to process camera films and how to print them. Generally... how the whole thing worked in hypo solution and so on, did some of it myself and organised the procedure there. Then I was made station intelligence officer, education officer. I was getting a bit fed up with all these jobs, but that's what they did with me,
What did that involve in education?
Well, it involved, it was a very, very big station with hundreds and hundreds of airmen. They were, to some extent, insufficiently educated, and they thought it desirable that they had somewhat better education. But with the officers on the station, and to some extent the sergeant and flight sergeants, there were some people there who could deliver lectures, and I organised those lectures in the evenings for the airmen who wanted to learn, shall we say, elementary maths and things of that sort. So I had to organise all those. And this is going on some years, and then I was eventually called into the chief ground instructor, who was a chap called Wanklin, Squadron Leader Wanklin, very affable chap with First World War ribbons, liked him a lot. He was the brother, I think, of the Wanklin who got a VC as a submariner. He said, right, I've got another job for you, Nesbitt. What's that, sir? He said, you're going to be entertainment officer. I said, entertainment officer? I don't know the first thing about entertainments. How can I possibly be entertainment? So I can't get up and entertain the troops, you know. Yeah, that doesn't matter, Nisbet. You can organise it. Off you go. Think about it. God, I haven't even thought about this entertainment business. So I put a notice in the airman's mess. Anybody who is interested in entertainments, report to me in the navigation section at such and such a time. At this time, there's a whole crowd of these chaps there. They had musical instruments with them. And they were an odd bunch. Really odd bunch, some of them. But they were a very amusing crowd. They weren't very disciplined. Their salutes were very perfunctory. But I said, well, now look, I'm now your entertainments officer. I've got to organise. I know nothing about entertainments. What do we want? They said, we want a stage. So I went to the engineer officer and said, look, I've been told via the station commander that I've got to be an entertainments officer. And we've got to have a stage. Now, the space in one of these hangars, how about building a stage? He said, oh, God. But he did it. He built the stage with curtains which opened, and he had two dressing rooms on either side. And this was introduced to these chaps, and they took it like a duck to water. They developed their own show, which they called Out of the Blue, in which they, part of them dressed up as women and part of them dressed up as men. And I remember they used to open this show with something which they copied from the Andrews sisters, if you remember who they were. What was it called? Something like the Burlesque Theatre. Some American thing which they sang, a little bit risky. And they put this show on, and everybody attended, and civilians attended it, the CEO attended it, and it was a roaring success. I didn't do anything. I mean, I certainly didn't appear in the show. But they did all that, and they were, some of them became quite well known in Britain after the war. I mean, it was a huge station, and if you get a huge station, there was you know, there were sufficient people who were knowledgeable on the subject. There's one other thing that happened on the station too, that they brought a lot of ex-prisoner of war into the station, Italians. Now, these Italians, I don't think ever wanted to fight in the war at all. And they billeted them not as prisoners of war, but with the other airmen. And the airmen protested about this. But what do we do? All these Italians, they could play musical instruments. They got up in the officers' mess with these musical instruments, and they played, I don't know, O Sole Mio or something like that. And next to no time, they were given pints of beer and became friends. And also, I had bought a car, a Model B Ford, an ancient 1926 car, which didn't run very well. And these chaps came over to this car, and they renovated it, and they even rebuilt the battery, repainted it. So I had this old 1926 car, in which I used to go out with my girlfriends there, with a dicky in the back, and used to go out to farms and things like that, and drive this car over Rhodesia. It was a lovely old car, beautiful car. There was a Model A car and a Model B car, and this was an old Model B car. It worked perfectly, especially over the rough roads which we had there. So then the other thing that happened was, you may not believe this, but Noel Coward appeared. And I had to produce the programme with Noel Coward. And anyway, he put on half the show and I put on the other half, or got these chaps put on the other half. I never appeared on stage at all. And so...
What was he like?
Well, he knew what I'd done. And when we went back to the officers' mess, I was there as a lowly flight lieutenant. And all the senior officers gathered in the mess with all the local dignitaries, and they were in one part of the mess, and there was Noel Coward chatting to me in the other, with his pianist. He brought his pianist with him, chatting to me for about an hour or something like that, and they were all looking a bit annoyed about it. But what could I do? He wanted to talk to me. So eventually he did depart from me and talk to these other dignitaries in the, you know, the Rhodesian hierarchy, which had come in to talk to this famous fellow.
What impressions did you gain of him?
Well, he was very friendly indeed. He was just a normal chap. But what did happen to him was that after the dignitaries had appeared, all the other officers descended on him. And we did what we often did in those days. We put some blacking on his shoes, turned him upside down, and made him walk across the ceiling, leaving the marks on the ceiling. He took it in very, very good part. What we did not realise at the time, that he very much enjoyed being handled by young RAF officers. We didn't understand his proclivities at all. But anyway, this show that we put on, I had to travel the whole length of, not with Noel Coward, but this Out of the Blue thing, with the whole length of Rhodesia. all the other stations put on the show, and all these other places which they had prepared for us. It was quite astonishing. I mean, I claim no credit for it whatsoever, except as on the organisational side. But these chaps, Joe Coley and all these other fellows, did go into ultimately into TV, I think, afterwards and so on. They were very good. They could play musical instruments. They could sing too, which I certainly can't. Never have been able to. So that was my experience there.
What was life like in Rhodesia for you?
Oh, it was enormously comfortable. It was admirable. It was what the airmen would call it, a cushy billet. We were adjacent to Salisbury. There was entertainment in Salisbury. There was a lot of hospitality there. It was a very pro-British place. Of course, there were what we call the natives there, the blacks. They were Matabele and Shoshona, mostly Shoshona around that area. Shona, they called them. I went into Salisbury in the evenings and learnt to some extent, took a course on Shona, Shoshona, and could speak it to some extent. We had two native black servants there, Isaac and Billy, their names were, and so I could converse with them in Shona and to some extent in other respects. I sort of liked learning these things, and I did contemplate perhaps going back there after the war, because it seemed a very prosperous place. It was known as the Jewel of Africa. But I started to feel restless there, I must admit.
Why was that?
Well, D-Day came along. I was still there. I felt I wasn't playing my part in the war as actively as I ought to. And it sounds rather stupid, but in the evening, sometime after that, there was this play, this film called about Henry the Fifth, wasn't it? Laurence Olivier, and there was this speech at Agincourt. I don't know if you remember, gentlemen in the now bed still think themselves accursed they were not here. I felt accursed. So I went to march into the next day to the squadron adjutant, squadron leader. Manklin said, "Look, sir, I think I've been long enough here. I want to get back and join a light bomber squadron." He said, "Do you think that'll make a difference, Nesbitt?" I said, "Well, maybe not, but it'll make a difference to me, I think." He said, "Well, you'll go when you can be sent, Nesbitt. That's all, get out." And so I went back and sat around and carried on with this.
Was that quite frustrating?
It was. I did feel that my elder brother, you see, was in the army. He was in the intelligence corps. My younger brother, by this time, one of the younger brothers had become a signaller, and he was been sent out to Burma. I felt I was not doing my work, job in the war, and I ought to do it. And I wanted to get home and get onto a squadron again.
Was it to some extent the fact that you'd been able to do your administrative duties quite well that had kept you there for that period of time?
Oh, without a shadow of doubt. I mean, I think actually when I did leave, finally, the station commander did come to the station and shake hands with me, the group captain. I think what I did there was appreciated. I got these jobs and nobody else seemed to get them ever. I was just the mug who always was given the admin work.
Do you think you may have got a posting earlier if you hadn't have been so effective in those roles?
I think it helped me in later life, without any shadow of doubt, because I did take a postgraduate course in business administration and I took it like a duck to water. But I suppose I must have had some organising ability which the others didn't have. I suppose I would tackle a problem without knowing a great deal about it and deliberately learn how to do it as quickly as I possibly could, whereas others would shy away from it. None of the pilots seemed to do any work at all in that respect. It was always the navigators who got these jobs. But in many ways, it was a very, very agreeable life out there. almost too agreeable.